Well, as you've probably noticed, this material really lends itself to wonderful byways and alleyways, and digressions and regressions and progressions.
Okay, good. Not progress to an amplification.
So I'll try to keep us on the main road with little detours that aren't too time-consuming as we go along. Okay, so on the basis of what we've done, let's now really try to use these tools to engage what can be a very tricky, kind of thorny, complicated question. What is the I? Who am I? We think of that as one of the perennial questions. Who am I? People go out under the stars, whether it's today or 2 million years ago. I think of a kind of a continuum, really, between us and our ancient ancestors, going all the way back to the first multicelled organism, 650 million years ago, and all the way back to life beginning, 3.5 billion years ago. I'm kind of an extension. So I want to extend to our cousins 2 million years ago who were making stone tools, smart enough to make stone tools, that even they, brains a third our size, could some evening stand there on the plains of the Serengeti, look up and go, what the? No. Who am I? So, who am I, right? Deep question. So when you tackle any kind of a deep question, I think it's really useful to start with some definitions. So this is how I'm going to use these terms. And I don't want to get lost in the words here. And as soon as possible, I want to move into an experiential orientation to this material, which tends to really ground it. The Buddha talked about a thicket of views, or the word papancha, which has a nice feeling in the mouth, papancha. In Pali, that means proliferation. And I think of proliferation as sort of a time-lapse movie, speeded up, of a jungle rainforest with vines and moving in all directions. It's really easy to proliferate concepts and talk and words and controversies about selfing. So I try to bring it down to earth with these definitions. So first of all, there's a person. There's clearly a person, right? There's an individual. This gentleman here is different from me. This lady there is different from me. If we start getting confused about that, it's psychosis, it's a problem, So there's a person. It's the body-mind as a whole, as I define it. All right? It has moral standing and moral duties. It has considerable consistency over time. Then there is the quote-unquote self. This is, how I mean it, the subjective sense of being an I. This very persistent sense of I, of me, of mine. It's the one that gets upset when you take things personally. Right? It's the one who says, do you think I'm great? Right? Or I want a cookie, or I want you to treat me better. Right? That's the psychological I in the Western sense of it. That's what I mean here by self. I'm not meaning self, capital S self, cosmic self, universal self. I mean it in a fairly ordinary sense of everyday life that we use it all day long, which is very generative of suffering, as we'll see. And you probably are well aware of already. That's what I mean by the I. The apparent, the presumed. And you can see how much in the West, in both philosophy and psychology, the self is just presumed. It's very often interesting to read psychological literature where people drop in the word self when they didn't really need to. Self-awareness. Well, maybe there's just awareness, right? Self-criticism, things like that. Although in that case, sometimes what is being criticized is the presumed self. Fundamentally, the presumed self is the owner of experiences and agent of actions. And then there's awareness. I don't want to conflate self and awareness. Again, sometimes people conflate self and awareness. Self is an object of awareness. As we'll see later, in my view, self is a process emerging and disappearing inside the field of awareness. No one yet knows how awareness represents experience. In other words, how in the world do we make sense of the as meaning the sounds that are moving from my mouth to your ears? How do we register the color red, the quality, they're called, of subjective experience? Nobody knows. I'm not going to answer that question today. But it is clear, experientially, right, that there is a field of awareness in which objects arise and pass away. Now, the Buddha said that basically awareness or moments of consciousness co-arise with our objects. That at any moment in time, you have a sense object, a sense organ, which includes the mind as the sixth sense organ, in addition to the eyes and the ears and the nose and so forth. And then you have sense consciousness, which is associated with that object. So in the Buddha's original, the Buddha's core teachings, there is no consciousness without an object. Consciousness itself, as he defined it, is not grounded in some universal field of awareness. That was more of a Mahayana development. Consciousness itself is very embedded in the body, and it's produced by causes and conditions and can pass away. I don't want to say too much more about that if I can help it. That at least is how he talked about it. Because he doesn't want us to cling to awareness itself. Awareness is a very attractive and subtle and seductive object of clinging. He's saying, abandon that as well. Because consciousness itself is subject to causes and conditions and is therefore an unreliable basis for true and lasting happiness. Even consciousness itself. So with these definitions then, the conventional notion of self, basically as I see it, and you see this again and again, sometimes in other words, really boils down to four things. The self is unified. There's just one self. It's a being. It's an entity. It's a noun. It's a thing. Someone looking out through the eyes. It's unified. Okay? It's also stable. It's the same one over time. There's the eye today, fundamentally, the core self. It's just the same self that was present when I was 4 years old. Right? However old you were when you were having your early experience. Okay? It's stable. Doesn't change in its essence. Self is also independent. In other words, you know, things happen to it, but it is not those things. It is independent of those things. Okay? Its essence persists independently. The ultimate notion of self, which the Buddha roundly critiqued at his time, was of this acausal soul essence that did not arise due to causes and conditions and just moved through time. Right? Atman. That's why not self is called anatta, not self. Interestingly, he talked about not self both in terms of that soul view, which was prevalent in Hinduism or the religions of his time. But he also talked about not-self in terms of the way I'm using the term, as the psychological self. I'm not going to talk about the soul, Atman, self, because I don't know enough to talk about that. All right? I'm going to focus here more on the conventional psychological self, you know, the I, the you. Okay? And then last, you know, self is who I am. It's my identity. I am me. The one I am is me, myself. Right? Those are the four attributes fundamentally when people talk about self. Right? So that's the conventional notion of self. And what I'd like to do actually is to explore if it's actually true. If it's really true in your own direct experience. Let's just see. Let's run the experiment. See for yourself. What I'd like to do in a moment is a practice with you in which we'll start with you seated, and I'll suggest that you stand up. By the way, when I use the word you, as much as possible, I mean the persons over there, rather than the selves, the eyes, the apparent eyes, because to forecast the end of the story and come back to it, I think the Buddha was right, in that neuroscience and neuropsychology show clearly that the apparent self is an illusion. There really is no such one. We'll come back to that further on. So anyway, so you, the persons, hopefully, I'll invite you to stand up, do some various things, and I'll invite you even to move around the room and take the body for a walk with as little sense of self as possible. And throughout, I invite you to notice the increasing and decreasing sense of I and the causes and conditions that amplify or activate or intensify the sense of I, or reduce it and let it fade away. I invite you also to be aware of different kinds of self, different kinds of I that emerge. right, as we do this, and what it's like to operate with very little sense of self. It's actually the case that we do all kinds of things all day long with little sense of I. In fact, sometimes no sense of I whatsoever, engaged with that thing. You know, we reach for the salt shaker without any particular sense of I. And we unconsciously adjust our posture in our seats with little sense of I. We don't really register it. We don't notice it. It's very, it's plain vanilla. It's the water we swim in. We don't notice we're wet. Right? So, but in this case, in this practice, I encourage you to be really mindful of, wow, the degree to which life goes on just fine with little sense of I running the show. Okay, so we'll try this and then we'll come back and talk about it. So, to try it, so if you could, water, tea, thank you, Chris, for my tea. All right. Now, observing the self can be a little tricky because it's the subject, you know, it's the one, it can feel like it's the one who's looking at it. So even that, just try to notice that. If selfing is arising related to trying to see the end of self.
Can I just follow something that you said often because I miss something in my life.
Uh-huh.
And when you say sense of life, you mean like being aware of what I'm doing. Does that mean? Knowing what I'm doing.
I mean it more like to, you know, when you really want something, like when something happens around you and you really want it. Or remember when the sounds happened earlier, you know, those intrusive sounds? You might have, in retrospect, you can recall there was a kind of flurry of eye arising. Like, how come they're doing that? Why could that be? I want it to go away. Can't they make it stop? You know, there's a stronger sense of self present. Also, often when we have a sweet reward in front of us, there's a strong sense of I. You know, in other words, I'm trying to get at the point that in our own experience, there is a sense of I, and typically we just simply identify with it. You know. Or if you imagine, just if you can recall some of your trains of thoughts where you're just sort of ruminating about things, you know, reflecting on, gee, what I'll do later today and how it will be, and if I do this, it won't go so well, but if I do that, it'll go better for me. Embedded in that is a me, who's the protagonist of the movie, of the story. That's the one I'm talking about. Or if someone disrespects you, imagine what it's like if someone comes up to you and is insulting. You know, you silly fool, whatever it is, that gets stirred up right then and there. And you think, how dare you treat me that way? That sense of I, that self. Or the I that wants to possess things, claim them as one's own. That's mine. That's my property. You know, imagine coming back on the break to your chair and someone else is sitting in your chair. Just that very ordinary moment. What are you doing in my chair? The my, right there. That's what I'm getting at. That my. Which the Buddha says is a major source of suffering. Right? That my. Or maybe you have a firmly held political view of one kind or another. Where something is of value for you. Like taking care of you know, the whales, or global warming, or children, or what have you, the rights of women, or what have you, right? You have firmly held value. When someone just starts talking in a way that totally contradicts or is contemptuous of those values, you know, or as Ronald Reagan in my country famously said, if you've seen one redwood tree, you've seen them all. What? You know, that, the one, you get activated there. What? Right? That's the one I'm talking about. Right there, suffering begins. That's the one to be aware of. That process is what I'm talking about being aware of.
I get it. It happened to me when I was charged a price for a cup of tea, which I thought was...
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. That's right. It's a sense of, as we'll see in the forecast, and you can watch it, I tends to activate it, and I, the selfing, to get ahead of myself a bit, serves functions. That's why I devolve. It serves functions. It keeps critters alive. Particularly advanced critters like us, who are very social critters. I also really emerges in contact with others. In the beginning, I'll suggest you don't look at anyone. But toward the end, I'll suggest, you know, start making eye contact. And notice what happens. There you are rolling along, this kind of peaceful sense of not much sense of self at all. You know, self has a kind of contracted sense to it. See if you can be aware of that as well. Right? And then you make eye contact, and then the social self activates like that. There you are walking down the street, just kind of flowing with the day. Da-da. Suddenly someone calls your name, you see an acquaintance over there, ba-boom, the personality gets loaded in RAM, you know, from the hard drive to RAM, 2 to 3 seconds, suddenly Rick's here, or Mary, or Sue, or Bob, whatever. And again, that one. Self tends to, you know, activate, I think you'll see, so I'll name this to look out for it. Self tends to really activate around just the big pleasant. In other words, real grasping. Self activates around real grasping for the major pleasant. And also self tends to also really activate around major unpleasant. In other words, major aversion to the unpleasant. And self tends to particularly activate in social contact. Right? So see for yourself what really is the case. But that's what I'm encouraging you to pay attention to. Alright, so let's try. So take a big breath. All right. Just take a moment right now to get a sense of the selfing right now in your mind. And trying to be aware of it, you might notice there's suddenly not much sense of I altogether. And then after a few seconds or a dozen or more seconds, suddenly there's a thought. You know, like, I don't think he's right. I don't think there's much sense of I. Well, who's the I that had the thought, I don't think he's right, or something, or whatever. Or, wow, he really is onto something. There really is, yeah, I really think there isn't much I here. Who's the I that's having that thought? Okay, so just take a moment here. Just kind of open up to, what is selfing like? Take a moment to explore body sensations in the legs or the chest, breathing, the face, perhaps, and explore the difference between there is sensation and I have sensation. One way to explore the sense of I or self is to deliberately intensify it and then step back and observe it. Try on the difference in awareness between the two statements, there is breathing and I am breathing. In a moment, wiggle your toes and explore the difference between the sense of toes are wiggling and I am wiggling my toes. In a moment, I'll suggest that you open your eyes. Before you open your eyes, get ready to notice what happens to the sense of self, of I, when eyes open. Often, the visual sphere, the visual sense is very associated with the executive systems in the brain, which are closely allied to the sense of I. See what happens in a moment. Whenever you like, as you choose, just gazing in front of you gently, what happens when you open your eyes? What's the difference between there are sights and I am seeing? Without making eye contact with anyone, experiment with gently moving your head or your gaze from side to side or around. And as new objects of sight enter awareness, explore the difference between new sights are appearing and I am seeing new things. As sounds enter awareness, explore the difference between there are sounds and I am hearing. Notice as well the associated qualities related to either a state of less self, as in there are sounds, there are sights, and the qualities associated or present, even subtle ones, when there is more sense of self, as in I am hearing or I am seeing. Does there are sounds, or there are sights, or there are sensations feel relatively peaceful? And alternately, is there any sense of contraction, tension in the sense of I? Be aware also of commentary arising in the mind. Commentary on anything, commentary on this practice. And there too, explore the difference between there is commentary, there are thoughts, there is a viewpoint, and I have this commentary. I am thinking. I hold this viewpoint. This is my perspective. In a moment, I'll suggest that you stand up. So in a moment, first prepare to stand up by scooching back in your chair, what have you. And notice what it is like or can be the distinction between a simple intention or movement or instruction to move back in the chair. There is the intention to move back in the chair versus I am intending to move. And noticing that difference, prepare to stand up. It's interesting to observe how much executive function can occur. In other words, intentions, instructions, movements, how much can occur with little to no sense of I? In a moment, I'll ask you to stand. And as you do, try to be aware of the differences between there is standing or standing is happening, and I am standing up. So, let standing arise. Just standing in place, maybe moving slightly if you need to make room for others. What happens to the sense of I with standing? Explore moving slightly in place. As you stand, perhaps swaying back and forth or adjusting your shoulders. And what is it like to move with more or less sense of I? Can you let the hands be the hands without making them my hands? Wiggling the fingers, explore the difference between there is sensation in those fingers and I am moving my fingers. Those are my fingers. In a moment, I'll suggest that you take the body for a walk. And to do that, we'll do that for about 3 to 4 minutes or so. It's okay to leave this room, just try to be sure to be back within 3 to 4 minutes. And if you can, don't make eye contact with others. And see what it's like to engage movement, even deliberate movement, with more or less sense of I. So for the next 4 minutes or so, how about taking the body for a walk? What's it like to relax your own sense of I, to simply receive others without activating me or I or mine? Simply letting there be eye contact without necessarily adding I to it. Finding your way back to your seat, still exploring the sense of what it's like to have more or less self-present. Even as we start to engage language, see what it's like for there to be more or less of an I present in the generation or perception of language. Can there be words? There are words, there are thoughts, there is directed speech without necessarily being I am talking, I am thinking, I am comprehending. So, how was that? What were some of the things you experienced? Are you hearing her? Is she loud enough? Great, because you're really describing, I think, so much of the feeling of this, yeah.
But I completely lost it in the walking and cooking. It was like, I was thinking, what am I doing? Am I pretending? Am I real? What should I expect? My eyes are...
Great. That's what I thought you discovered. I didn't want to prejudge the experiment, but I think you've said a number of qualities. One, there are distinctions between the sense of self and not, right, more or less. And in the sense of self, very often there's a subtle sense of anxiety and also performing or aiming, you know, goal attained, right? Either increasing the pleasant or decreasing the unpleasant in our goal attained. Right? And also social contact, eye contact. Woo! Really simulates lots of something. Many people would experience. I'm not saying necessarily had to have that experience, but very often that's what you would directly encounter. Maybe another person or two? Yeah.
Just notice the strongest sense of eye, making eye contact with people I knew.
Yes, versus people you didn't know. Yeah, that's right. Isn't that interesting? It's like, I think one of the things we'll see is that the self is very deeply socially constructed. And it's a social organ in a sense. It's very involved in contact between people. I think in part because it served evolutionary functions. We presume an eye on the other, just like we presume an eye over here. Okay, a couple more.
Yeah, I think I didn't hear terribly well what she was saying, but what I think she was getting at is that when you were saying to yourself, there is sensational, there is seeing. There is hearing. There is a distinct difference when you say I am hearing. It, as you said, there's a sense of anxiety. There's a sense of it became more questionable. It was so when there is hearing, I am hearing. I am hearing is sort of more questionable than there is hearing. It's freer.
Ah, yeah.
There is hearing. It's freer. There is seeing. It's freer.
Yeah.
And yes, it's. As my friend said, when you leave eye contact with somebody you know, it's as if the personality is already ready made and it comes straight up.
Yes.
It slots into place.
That's it. It's like loading the program.
Yeah.
You know, it's like activating Word for Windows or something, you know, in my kid's PowerPoint. Yeah. A couple more. Yeah, to you and then I'll move on. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the activating the program. For me, it's I was very aware of when I was embodied and relaxing, it was fine. It was cool. It was really. I went into that hall and I was suddenly back in my secondary school in an amazing thing. And all weekend I thought, gosh, the way I was then, it was anxiety, fear, you know, all. And I thought, gosh, I'd really like to have a different life for the day. That was a flash.
Yeah.
And then the anxiety and then the kind of disembodiment instantly. And I thought, well, this all happened in a split second. All those choices were all kind of fear. We're based on fear, what to do now, and regression, like previous relations or ways of being, all kind of congealed into this who I became. And then that, you know, and the other thing is when we're walking around, when I was embodied, we felt relaxed. It's lovely to meet people, and some people felt more relaxed, and I felt like they loved. And if people felt a bit, ooh, I don't know quite where they're at, the anxiety of somebody being unknown or not quite there, ooh, that made me feel very. So, you know, the fantastic relaxation and ease.
Yeah.
And then the horrendous anxiety.
It's so remarkable, isn't it?
Wow, that's
a lot,
you know, sounds so unnecessary.
Yeah,
isn't
that just
remarkable?
Yeah.
That's an inside then.
I mean, yeah.
I think that's
going to now fly out to the night. Oh, that's great. It's really great. And isn't it interesting? That was about 15 minutes total tops. About 15, I think. And I'm sure there are people for whom that distinction was not so sharp. But I think I'm hearing seeing a lot of nods, you know, there is that distinction, or if you even get it for a minute or two or less, you get it. Wow, there really is that distinction.
But it, you know, the power of being embodied and present, and
yes.
It just really struck me
that,
I mean, that was literally a bombshell,
really. Oh, yeah, no. Take in the good. Let that bombshell just explode and spread. And well, the good bombshell. The good bombshell.
Being on your own side,
that's the
thing. Because what you were saying yesterday about being, I felt, I'm on my own side in a very nice, relaxing location.
Yeah.
Totally okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lovely line about this from a meditation teacher, I think Southeast Asian, who plays with language in this way. He says, love yourself, but don't love your self. Right? Love the person. Take care of the person. Nourish the person. Be the steward of the person. You know, when we have, you know, the ones we have the greatest duty to are the ones we have the most power over. Who's the one we have the most power over? It's the future person we're going to live into. The next minute or year or decade from now. Right? Take good care of that person. That's different from glorifying and tweaking and tuning or improving the I. The experience that this one over here has, you know, that I have, it's interesting how the Buddha did use the word I, but I think he's clearly referring to the person altogether. So that's how I'm trying to mean that word right now. You know, in the state of just there is contact, there is presence, there is other, there is here, now, us, right? In that way of being, it feels a little bit like it's coming through. It's not sticking over here. Whereas when I gets activated socially, it feels like what's happening is kind of getting stuck, like ornaments getting hung on a Christmas tree, for better or worse, and then that creates a kind of agitation. How will I respond to that which is getting stuck? Whereas when there's less sense of I, personally, more just, it's all right, it's okay, it's there, it's allowing, it's wind blowing through. All right, one more and then I'll move on. Yeah.
Yeah, just one point I found interesting was it felt like there was a reduction in feedback from me. And analogously, it was a kind of like a radar, or decreased sort of afferent drive, if you like.
Yeah.
But there was less. It wasn't like there was a need for a modification of what was going on when I was less, when I was more detached from my sense of my sort of ego.
Yeah, that's very. I thank you. That's fresh for me to reflect on. You know, certain neurolingo down regulation of inputs, efforts. You know, as others probably know, are inputs. Because we don't need it so much. There's less of that sticky core that needs that feedback. It's more just, it's all right. It's like it's allowing flow. Yeah.
It's almost like the center didn't need to be updated of any new.
Right. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. That's very interesting. Thank you. Okay. So, isn't it quite striking that right here and right now, you probably encountered one or more of these aspects of the actual experience itself, distinct from the presumed self. And what I'd like to do, I think, is in the next 15 minutes or so, move fairly briskly through a chunk of material and just then take a lunch break, buy some time in the afternoon for practices, and give you some things to reflect on at lunch. So if you bear with me, I'll tend to move fairly quickly through, and we can swing back and talk about this. So I suggest that in your actual experience, what was present there, really, in the experience, was that self seemed to have many parts. You know, there was the self that emerged interpersonally, there was the self that decided or didn't decide to stand up, there was the self that got irritated because someone was standing next to you and kind of elbowing you, or too close, or whatever, the self that felt better when the room got cooler, whatever it was, you know, many, many parts. I think of the eye who sets the alarm clock with the intention to get up to exercise early in the morning, and the other eye who wakes up and goes, "Who set the damn clock?" Right? Self has many parts, many sub-personalities. You know, the brain is this giant network system. I think of self as a village, self as a menagerie, self as a zoo. Right now, I'm reading The Life of Pi, a wonderful book actually, which I had not really appreciated how wonderful it is until now. It's a lot about zoos and zookeepers and, you know, zoobies and so forth. So anyway, it's compounded. In other words, it's not unified. And also, instead of being stable, it's actually very transient and impermanent. You could see it, right? Yeah, self was this way, it rose, it fell, it increased, it decreased, it shifted this way, it shifted that way. It had a very impermanent quality to it. It was not stable over time, right? And third, rather than being independent, okay, it's dependent. In other words, that the amount of self that is or is not present is depending on intention, just your own intention in this practice to play around with. You know, there is sensation in the toes, or I am experiencing the sensation in my toes waking. That's a dependency. It's also dependent on my suggestions. It's dependent on who you managed to bump into. Was it someone you knew or someone who was a stranger to you here? Right? Very dependently arising. Very dependently arising. As I alluded to earlier, very often what we see is that self particularly activates around those three things. You know, significant rewards, significant threat, and significant interpersonal contact. Particularly when it arises. Both based on external stimuli and internal. There you are just kind of rolling along, and for some reason in your chain of free associations, you think about your father or your mother. And then in that, kaboom, there's this kind of presumed I that's activated in reference to that object, that, you know, subject and object. Right? So whether it comes from the inside or the outside, you know, there are all these factors that lead to the ebbs and flows of self. In effect, self is a verb. You know, as Buckminster Fuller famously observed, I seem to be a verb, not a noun. In other words, and it's also interesting, I found this out a few years ago, it's quite interesting, that in the language of early Buddhism, Pali, basically there are no nouns. There are only verbs and gerunds. So a dog is not a dog, it's dogging, right? Water is not water, it's watering. You know, it's processual. It's a processual language. It's very process-focused. There's no self, there's self-in. And just that way of thinking about it lightens it up, even self-in, right? It's process, very dependently arising. And then last, as one could see, it's interesting that I emerged as a content in mind, didn't, within a larger whole that included sights, sensations, sounds, intentions, executive functions, all kinds of stuff is arising, and then me shows up. Did you notice that very often me shows up on the heels of a stream? Something happens, there's a stimulus, you think of something, so there's the stimulus, and then I kind of organizes around that stimulus and then claims it for itself. I think of the self, to some extent, as like a little kid that's running behind a parade saying, look what I've created, look what I've created, right? As if it's his or her own, right? So self is not the identity. Okay. It's simply an aspect of the apparent self, self-being, self-activation, self-representations. The sense of self arising and passing away is just one more content of mind. To preview some of where we're going, in effect, if you think of it, selfing doesn't need to be a problem if we don't identify with it. problem is we make self the preeminent subpersonality. We privilege it. Right? It's, we identify with it above all else, above all other contents of mind. If it's allowed to simply be a transient content of mind, arising and passing away, and seen fundamentally as empty, in Buddhist terminology, in other words, that it arises dependently, interdependently, it has no absolute self-existence. If we allow self to be seen in this way as transient and empty, then it doesn't need to be such a problem, such an affliction, such a source of suffering. So there we are, right? We have this direct experience of self that contradicts the characteristics of the presumed. And one of the things we see, of course, is that the self serves functions. That's a great way to think of it. What's the function that self serves? And as this quote talks about, well, it points out, you know, the self, the putative, the apparent self, arose as an adaptive mechanism to preserve survival, to promote survival. So far we've looked at self in the mind. Now I want to talk about self in the brain. So it's interesting as well that in the brain, and I'll show you some images that support this view, in the brain you see the same thing, that the various circuits or networks that support self-representations or self-activations, etc., including even the bare sense of subjectivity, you know, of being the one to whom or to which things happen, is compounded. It's all over the place. There's no neural network for eye. There are neural networks for tracking facial recognition. There are neural networks for working memory, upper, outer, front. There are neural networks for reacting to frightening stimuli, the amygdala. There is no region of the brain that does so. It's also the case that in the brain, self-thing is impermanent, it's transient. Circuits light up here, they quiet down, they activate over there, they quiet down. I think of these circuits a little bit like the lights going up and down on an amplifier. You know, as the music plays and different frequencies go up or down, you know, like that. That's happening in the brain as well. It also is dependent in the brain. Selfing is dependent moment to moment in the brain based on different stimuli. And it's also dependent, in terms of deep time, on the evolution of these circuits in the brain. For example, spindle cells are a recent cell that's only present in the primate lineage, in the great apes, which include us, as well as the gorillas, bonobos, chimpanzees, and orangutans. Those are the great apes. Spindle cells are found in the anterior cingulate cortex, which does the executive control of attention and also a fair amount of self-awareness, as well as the insula, which tunes into the interior state of the body. Those are two parts of the brain I showed you in the very beginning that are developed by meditation. Remarkably, I found out recently, spindle cells are also found in the great whales, you know, in dolphins. Isn't that quite remarkable? An independent pathway, a very social species. Spindle cells are very involved in empathy. They're a social function. Okay, so yeah, in that sense, those, you know, neural substrates of self in the brain depend on evolutionary time. Okay, some images of this. In this first one, this was a literature review of many studies of different activations in the brain of three particular self-related activities. One, picking one's own photograph out of a group of photos, right? Recognizing the photograph. Two, pulling up a personal memory of what I did over the summer. And three, making a moral choice or taking a stance, for example, for or against legal abortion. And what's found, and I forget which ones went to which, but you see the diamonds, the X's, and the squares, those map to each one of those three types of studies. They're distributed all over the brain. In other words, in the title of this paper, is self special? The answer is no. There's no particular place for self in the brain. You see more... Oops. Can I jump ahead? Oh, good. That's okay. There is, interestingly, in your handout, there's a picture just before this image of the network of the brain. I don't have this in the slide set for some reason. But again, it's the same point. Self is widely distributed. Selfing our activities, processes, are widely distributed throughout the network system. And then the slide just after that one, in your handout, which now is back on track, is another very interesting study. Basically, let's see. This is a literature review of many, many studies where many, many self-related activities or choices or engagements were contrasted with other focus. For example, a person might be asked, what do you think about Obama, Barack Obama, right? Or what do you think about the current government in Britain, right? What does your best friend think about the current government in Britain? Whatever, there's a distinction between me and you, or something like that, right? Notice how widely distributed the white dots are, all over the brain. No particular place in the brain. The other thing is notice that the white dots are totally mixed up with the blue dots. In other words, self-related activations flow through regions of the brain that also do all kinds of other things. If you think of the brain or neural processes by analogy as a bit like a river, you know, self-related activations are just more flotsam and jetsam amidst all the other twigs and leaves and, you know, dead muskrats floating downstream, right? Self is not special in the brain. Here either. Now, what about, though, that in very deep sense of being the one to whom things happen, that sense that's present, even in deep practice, even when there's a lot of ekagata, a lot of unification of awareness, even there, when there's little sense of I, there's a very bare sense of you know, awareness having a localization, right, of subjectivity, if you will. And that's why I think it's really important to try to think clearly through this notion of subjectivity, right? In other words, there is the object and the knowing of the object. What has a sense that's very hard to eliminate. In the upper limits of practice, I think in deep jhana practice and out into the formless jhanas, and then into the liberation of the arhat. By the way, self is very intractable. In Buddhism, you may know there are four stages of awakening, four stages of enlightenment. Starts with stream entry, ends in being an arahant. And one of the fundamental characteristics of an arahant is the subtlest sense of self is eradicated. But it's only at that last stage that the subtlest seeds of self are actually eradicated. So it's quite intractable. It's not tractable. It's quite, it really holds on, right? It's got a grip. On it. So let's appreciate that as we go forward in practice. All right? But even at the upper, so I think at the upper limit, that sense of subjectivity alters. But before then, there really is a sense of subjectivity. But does subjectivity necessarily mean there is a subject? I don't think so. In other words, ordinary awareness has an inherent subjectivity. It's localized here. It's associated with a particular perspective, a particular body mind. It has a particular history. Right? If there were your thoughts in this mind, that would be really creepy, right? These thoughts are in this mind, localized this body, moment after moment after moment. Okay. So what the brain does, though, with that, is it indexes across those moments, because yes. There is a localization of awareness. It's associated with a particular perspective. It's associated with a background sense of the body, right? Which is deeply layered all the way down in the brainstem. It's very primal, that background sense of the body. What some people would call the proto-self, the localization of awareness here. I don't think you need the word self. The proto-person, if you will, proto-awareness, proto-subjectivity. It is localized here. But it occurs and passes away moment after moment after moment. What the brain does is it indexes across moments, much as the eye indexes across 24 frames per second of a horse galloping across a field to discern a single object that's moving over time. So the brain indexes across these experiences of subjectivity to find an apparent subject. You can actually allow there to be no subject. There is subjectivity, but that doesn't necessarily mean a subject. Awareness requires subjectivity, particularly ordinary awareness, the sight of arahantship or the formless jhanas. But it does not entail necessarily a subject. In my view, see for yourself. But for me, this was kind of a breakthrough when I began to think this way. When I began to realize that there is irreducible subjectivity, but in Western psychology and philosophy, the inherent processual subjectivity, the subjectivity that's embedded in the process of awareness, does not necessarily mean that there is an entity, a being, looking out through the eyes. A one who is aware. Aware. Yeah. And then I'll keep...
Isn't the brain just linked across, indexed across, because there needs to be continuity in action, in walking,
Yeah. Totally right. It does these things to help us, in a sense. You know, it wants to promote survival. You're exactly right. So it's actually correct that the brain does that to help us. But as a result, the brain separates us from the world to help us. It presumes a lot of separations. But in fact, really, there's tremendous interdependent arising of oneself and others in the whole world. It's just that beings in our history who were really grounded in oneness, you know, didn't really necessarily very skillfully distinguish themselves and the, you know, leopard jumping on them, right? Or between themselves and the other animals or primates in the land that were angry at them. So you're exactly right. I agree with you totally. I'm just saying that if we, with our intellect, we can see through that, and in direct experience, we can see now and now and now and now, there really is subjectivity, particularly when the mind is relatively quiet in meditation. But, that does not necessarily mean there is an entity, a noun, a being, that is the subject. Okay? In other words, to sum up, from a neurological standpoint, just as from a direct experiential standpoint, you engaged in the practice we did, the everyday feeling of being a unified self is actually an illusion. So the apparently coherent eye is built up in many subsystems. The apparently stable eye is produced by variable activations, rising and falling and passing away. The apparently independent eye arises dependently based on preceding causes and conditions. In effect, neurologically, as in psychology, self is empty. Self lacks absolute inherent existence. It's distributed widely. There, you want to know where yourself is? You want to know where you are? Right there, those white dots. Right? All over the brain. That's the self. It's a network phenomenon, if you think of it. Arising and dispersing away. Okay? So, here's two quotes that are really worth reading. You know, it's the idea that the apparent self was never there. All alone, you know? Now, one prompt for me to engage this was, I thought about people saying, there is no self. And I thought, well, what do you mean, there is no self? What does that actually mean, you know? And that's where I started thinking about self as a unicorn. In other words, representations of self arise in the mind. Right? When there was more sense of self, those representations were real. And in ways that are mysterious, yet in Western science, at least, it's completely presumed, those, the sense of self that arose mapped to related neural activations that were completely material. Just as, for example, if you think to yourself, 2 + 2 = 4, right? Or, you know, the North Pole is where Santa is, whatever. Those thoughts are real in the sense that the information, the mind, which I mean by information, of the thought maps to a very material substrate in ways that are mysterious but are presumed. Okay? Just like it was presumed that the Earth went around the Sun in the time of Copernicus, but no one knew why or how that happened. Right? It's presumed. Okay, those are real. So representations of self are real. The distinction, though, is, let's say, between a horse and a unicorn. In other words, representations of a horse are real, in the sense that they have existence, they exist. And they point to a real entity. Like, I think horses are real. I know maybe it's all just made up and we're like in some stoner dream, you know, the giant somewhere dreaming this, we're all going to disappear. But I think this stuff's real. Okay? I think horses are real. On the other hand, I'm sorry, I know probably some people it's offensive, but I don't think unicorns are real. It's in the same way. I know, darn. At least not anymore. So we have real representations of unicorns, but they point to a mythical beast. In the same way, we have real representations, variable qualities, and causes and fates of self that arise in the mind and therefore the brain. But that which they point to is also a mythical beast. That, too, I think, is a useful distinction. They're real representations of an unreal entity. Well, self does have its uses. Right? For example, notice the difference. If someone says to you something like, you know, in the space here, arising mysteriously, limitlessly, here and now, there is so much love. Right? Okay. Versus, I love you. Which would you rather be on the receiving end? Okay. It has its use. You know, or which would you rather be on the receiving end of? Something like, you know, there is fidelity and conscientiousness and faithfulness here. Or, I am not going to let you down. Which would you rather be on the receiving end? If you're a kid, what do you want to hear your parents say to you? You know, if you're a mate or a partner, you know, or in combat or whatever, you want to feel that. You know, there's a place for that. I think self-related processes helped our ancestors be more motivated for survival. I know for myself, when I've been in difficult situations in the outdoors where we have to really get our act together if we're going to get down alive, and I've been there. I'm here to tell the tale. I really did make it. Anyway, I'm real. I'm real. There was a lot of self present, and I'm glad there was. You know, and I wasn't doing self as a unicorn when I was trying to get down off the damn rock in the rain. You know, so I'm going to get out of here, get back to the car, and get back to the bar and have a beer. You know, I'm out of this. Okay. So if you think about it, the benefits of a parent self, as you're getting at, in a sense, over there in the back, much like how the brain indexes across time has its benefits, the benefits of the parent self have been gradually stitched in DNA, you know, over countless generations. The tendency is quite strong, right? That's why it's the last to go, as one enters the fourth stage of awakening. So it has its uses, right? But on the other hand, boy, oh boy, oh boy, selfing leads to suffering. You know? When, as I said earlier, I mean, mine are mental objects like any other, you know, it's still a problem. The Buddha routinely, it's really quite interesting, isn't it? You know, here's the great teacher of not self, okay, who used the word you and I constantly throughout the Dharma. What in the world is he talking about? You know, if we understand that self there is this fictional object, it's a useful fiction. You know, we're presuming a unicorn right here and right now because it's useful, it's working for us, fine. But when we privilege these representations by identifying with them, by claiming them as me, then suffering begins. You know? The key, I think, is to be able to move into and out of more or less self based on its functional utility, rather than being captured by habitual self habits, the habit of self. As they say on death row and in the monastery, no self, no problem. I've actually heard that. Actually, that's where I heard it. You know, inmates said, you know, self, no problem, you know. And it's like, yeah. And I've heard also monks say it as well. I thought that was quite cool. That's what I've heard. Whereas the Buddha says, you know, the highest bliss is the release of an engagement with or identification with or presumption of existence as an I, a me, a mine. It's quite remarkable. I mean, this is a teaching that's deeply renunciate, right? Where he really talks about giving up the attachment to it. Not giving up necessarily the experience of it. The Buddha enjoyed pleasure, many kinds of pleasures, including deep pleasures of the jhanas, and the pleasures of camaraderie, really, you know, sangha, community. But giving up, you know, attachment to pleasure, boy, a lot of dharmas about that. And nonetheless, he's placing, you know, the release of the conceit, he called it that word, conceit, or the presumption of I am, as the highest bliss. Right? You know, the study of self is deep, deep, deep in practice. You know, Dogen famously says here, you know, to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. To have that experience, I think she said in the back so eloquently, when there's less self, there's more sense of just the streaming of the moment passing through, you know, coming through as us. A metaphor I'll leave you with just before lunch, and we'll come back and unpack some of this and experience more about it, is to think of personhood as like a swell on the sea. Think of the big ocean, way out there in the Atlantic or the Pacific or wherever. There are all these swells, aren't they? They emerge, and they have their unique character. And if we imagine kind of slowing time down or imagining swells that last for 80 or 90 years or something, and we think, okay, each one of those is a human life. Each swell has its unique nature. And yet, each swell is part, clearly, of the larger whole. Each swell interacts with other swells, but each swell is an emergence of the larger whole into unique existence, having certain impacts, in a sense, as persons, deserving of certain kinds of treatment. And when its time comes, settling back down into the allness that it emerged out of and always was all along, as one whole thing. That's the true nature of things, really. That is the truth of things. And relaxing more and more into that and disengaging increasingly from the sense of I, me, or mine is increasingly to live in harmony with the truth of things, which is really what the Buddha taught is the fundamental basis of freedom from suffering and its causes. So for lunch, may your swells be swell. And how about coming back at 2:30? Okay?
Good idea.
And on lunch, if I may suggest as a practice, explore what it's like. You know, and you can't do it all the time. It's like the millipede, you know, twisting itself in knots when it starts thinking about how it walks. But from time to time, observe the rising and fall of selfing during lunch. And see what it might be like to make contact with the person who takes your order for lunch or what have you. You know, with more or less sense of self. Okay?
Rick, thank you so much. So many people have said to me over the last couple of days, my goodness, the quality and the depth and the usefulness of what Rick is giving us is really remarkable. I think there's a lot of agreement about that.
I'm kind of the messenger, though. I'm really the messenger for this stuff. That's how I see it.
Yeah. Great. Well, a very, very skillful messenger. And really wanted just to remind you about our way of showing our appreciation to Rick for that and for what we're receiving from him. A number of people are here as a sort of continuing professional development in terms of their work as therapists. And if you think of what you would normally pay for that, what any of us would normally pay in the sort of commercial marketplace, and the difference between that and the sort of London Insight fee, which only covers the administration and the hire of the woman. Sound engineers and people like that. the contrast between those two is obviously quite considerable, and that's really the space that we invite you to fill with your financial donations to Rick. He's doing this for no fee at all. He's continuing the 2,600 year old practice of the Buddha's teachings being given for free. And of those who receive them, supporting the teachers to enable them to do that. And increasingly, as you can imagine, Rick is in demand as a Dharma teacher who is working on a Dharma basis. And so really, please do step in and support him and enable him to do that. I'll persuade him to come back to London. But also, just really, it's our way of supporting the Dharma, taking this really distinctive form in our time in this intersection with neuroscience, of which Rick is, you know, we're being taught by, you know, a world expert in that these 2 days. So do please make good use of the shoebox on the end of the table there, which is the Dana box. Checks can be made, they're payable, they'll go to Rick, but they're payable to Louise, who will siphon them through to America for him. But please do make good use of that. I always think it's important to remember this is not about a tip. That's sometimes our model, you know, as English people particularly, it's our model, you know, to think in terms of tips. Dana is something quite different. We're talking about somebody's livelihood, somebody who has all the same bills, has kids, has, you know, a lifestyle that requires, you know, financing. And so really invite you to give generously to support it. In terms of food, the cafe, I'm afraid, is not open today on Sunday, but Euston Station holds lots of delights over the road. And there are other places down that way if you'd like to. There's a drinking fountain downstairs if you want to fill up water bottles. Could you just say again what time we're to come back?
Oh, and if I could say a word about Dana, too.
Please,
Chris
do.
Gives the most direct financial appeal I've ever heard. Most people are more discreet, including myself, or circumspect. You know, really, if you think about Dana, which means generosity, yeah. It was typically the Buddha's first teaching wherever he went. It's quite remarkable to think about it. And Dana is given in so many forms. Just your attentiveness, your eyes, your presence, your practice here in this room, that's Dana. That's your generosity right there. Just showing up, doing this rather than, you know, staying home and watching the American World Series, because I know you're all glued to the tube. You know, that's Dana, right? There are many forms of Dana. I welcome good chocolate, dark chocolate. Someone gave me some yesterday. Advice, I get that sometimes. Poetry, you know, suggestions, it's all good. But the main thing about it is to do it as a practice yourself. Whatever makes your heart happy, that's about it. It's about a movement of the heart, of happiness of the heart. And as to come back, still come back if you could, at 2:30. Okay?
Great.
And remember, more or less self, see what happens. Enjoy.
Hello. Are we on or not?
In 5 minutes, I'll tell you. I'm not sure.
Because I think you need